Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Luke's English Podcast is sponsored by iTalki, a very, very convenient and simple way to find one-to-one teachers for lessons and conversations online. The way it works is that first you choose your teacher. You can watch the teacher's video introduction, read reviews of their lessons from previous students. And when you've found the teacher that suits you, you can just simply choose a date and time that's convenient for you, and then take your lesson on Skype or other video chat software. It's very professional, very, very easy to use, and millions, literally millions of people around the world are using iTalki to learn languages. And when you buy some talking time, iTalki will send you a voucher for a free lesson because you listen to this podcast. To get the offer, go to teacherluke.co.uk/talk or click an iTalki logo on my website. You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. Hello, everyone, and welcome all of you to this new episode. You're listening to number 638, and this is the second part in this series I've decided to call Quintessentially British Things That You Might Not Know About, in which I talk to members of my family about things that they think are significant or typical examples of Britishness in their eyes. I'm assuming that you've heard the previous episode in which James told us about five interesting English things. Now it's my dad's turn, and we decided to go for just three things this time instead of five to make sure the episode didn't go on too long. So you're going to hear my dad describing certain aspects of Britain that include things like ancient history, the geographical and geological nature of these islands, and how the Industrial Revolution changed the country. There's plenty of very descriptive language from my dad, plus quite a lot to learn in terms of history and geography. You'll notice that it sounds a bit like the Rick Thompson Report at the beginning, as we discuss what it really means to be British, as opposed to English, Scottish, Irish, or Welsh. And there's talk of the Scottish independence movement, but my dad assures me that his three things can definitely be considered British rather than just English. We recorded this together in the living room at my parents' place on New Year's Eve. And in fact, we were still recording at the stroke of midnight. So you can hear Dad and me wishing each other a Happy New Year, enjoying some fireworks on TV, and seeing in the beginning of the new decade together. I think you know the concept of the episode now, so I'll just let you enjoy listening to my dad talking about some British things that he likes in particular. Hi, Dad.
Hello, Luke.
How are you?
I'm okay, thank you.
Very good.
Nice to talk to you again.
Nice to be talked to again.
Yes.
So we're talking about, well, I still haven't really decided what the title of these episodes is going to be yet. I was talking to James about this, and I thought that I would probably call it something like Quintessentially British Things or Quintessentially English Things That You Might Not Know About. Okay, so are the things that you've chosen, are they British or are they English?
Oh, they're British, and I got the idea that you wanted me to talk about things I like about Britain.
Okay, that's good. The main thing is that we talk about British things that are sort of not the usual cliches.
Not cliches.
Yeah. Mm,
okay.
The usual cliches being, you know, fish and chips, Mr. Bean, you know, that kind of thing. Okay, so they're all British things, are they?
Yes, they are British things. I mean, I think that when I think, why do I like Britain? And nearly everybody likes the place they come from.
But they're definitely British. So at least one of these things is either Welsh or Scottish Northern Ireland.
I think you'll find that.
Okay,
yes.
Okay. It's just, I thought I'd make that distinction. Just because I think a lot of the time, the English say British, and they prefer the word British because it feels more inclusive, whereas people in Scotland or Wales or Northern Ireland, depending on how they feel about the whole arrangement, might prefer the word Scottish.
Well, this is all about identity now, which is brought into question now by, you know, Brexit, which has divided the country. And so, obviously, there's a lot of discussion, writing about identity. You know, are the Scots really British? Do the English want to be British, or do they want to be English? The Americans always call us English anyway, wherever we come from.
Well, yeah, that's because it's confusing. But the Americans, they sort of often confuse English and British.
But so we now have Scotland wanting, at least the ruling party in Scotland, the Scottish National Party, wanting to be independent and calling for another referendum. They've had one already, which didn't pass.
Mm-hmm.
Because they voted significantly to stay in the EU. They don't want to leave the EU. They feel as though they're being dragged out of the EU by London. And, in a similar way to Northern Ireland, they voted to remain in the EU as well.
Mm.
And so it's becoming very divisive. And so the identity of whether we're British, whether we're Scottish, Welsh, Irish, English, or all of them, is being questioned. No, I don't worry. I'm going to talk about Britain.
Okay. All right, then. And I think that's enough Brexit.
It certainly is.
This isn't the Rick Thompson report.
No, it's not.
You're being brought in as just a normal guest.
yes, I'll try and be normal.
Do your best. I know it's difficult. Shall we start with your first British? How many things have you chosen?
You asked me to do three things, general subjects, really.
I've with James, it was five, and I thought that would be the right number, but I felt like it was a few too many, so three.
Oh, you don't want to go on too long. Everyone out there will fall asleep.
Well, we've been through this many times.
Mm.
Some of them probably do fall asleep. Some of them listen while driving, which is a bit of a worry.
Anyway, it's three things that I quite like about Britain. And what I was saying earlier is that I imagine around the world, everybody has an affection for the country they were born in.
Yeah.
It's just kind of instinctive. We're tribal, and it can get a bit ridiculous that, patriotism and nationalism can go completely ridiculous and not rational.
Mm.
It is the greatest country in the world. There's people who haven't been to very many countries in the world. And,
yeah.
No, I'm not going to do that, but I do have an affection for Britain, the land of my birth, and it's basically related to related to history and geography more than pop culture and the famous, trendy pop art music thing that we're famous for, or comedy, or some of the things that are in the popular culture domain. Now, I think I'm more interested in something that goes back in time a bit more than that.
Okay, so history and geography, and maybe, can I say, geology?
Yes.
Okay, so let's talk about your first thing. What's the first thing that you've chosen to talk about?
I thought the first thing would be about ancient Britain and the monuments we have all over these islands, because we're a group of islands, and I'm rather interested in these things. People will know Stonehenge; it's a famous World Heritage Site, but it's not the only one. And there's a lot of interesting remains from prehistoric times, and they're mysterious. People have lots of theories about them, but what they do demonstrate is that there were very sophisticated societies here on these islands. What's Stonehenge? 3,000 BC. Let's call it 5,000 years ago.
Yeah.
5,000 years ago, which we don't know anything about. I mean, there are no written records. There's occasional scratchings on stone, runes, old lettering.
Why do we not know about those times? In the UK, at least.
Well, there's nothing written. There were no books. There's nothing that's remained of it. We can only speculate from the things that have survived, some ancient jewels, some marks, some stones. And the Stonehenge period, which I think is Neolithic, and it must have been a really sophisticated chain of societies.
Why?
Well, they have amazing kind of rituals. Obviously, there were a lot of rituals, so there must have been some kind of deeply felt religion. And the amount of effort they put into making these monuments, monuments to the gods or to the sun and to the moon, which I think is really quite intelligent, because mm-hmm. without the sun, we're all dead. And I think it was really powerful that, you know, they wanted the sun, which goes lower and lower and lower and lower in the sky, and it gets colder and colder, and nothing grows, and then the sun starts to rise again. And they must have felt that there was something they could do to make it happen. They were afraid it might not happen.
Right.
So the amount of effort they put into these things is fantastic. So we start off with Stonehenge in Wiltshire, in the south of England. When it was built, it was all wooded there. It's now Salisbury Plain.
Can you just describe Stonehenge for us? Just, obviously most people know it. A lot of people would have seen it, but just tell us what it looks like.
It's a circle of stones. It is actually built on the site of a wooden one. People know that from the fence posts they found in the ground. Mm-hmm. So originally there was a wooden palisade, then it became a stone one. The stone one is you know, 2,500 BC. And these are enormous stones made from very hard rock, which apparently comes from the Welsh coast.
Yeah.
And how did they... 150 miles.
150 miles away.
Okay. So how did they get them up there onto Salisbury Plain? How did they do it? And most theories reckon that they were kind of hewn with very crude axes from the rock on the coast of Pembrokeshire, and then put onto logs and rolled all that way, with presumably with teams of horses pulling them and teams of people moving the log from the back to the front again so that they kept on going. It's very difficult to imagine how they managed to do it.
Would have taken a long time.
But each of these stones, you know, weighs 25 tons or something.
Yeah.
I have another theory, which is not my theory, actually.
It's not only that as well, sorry to interrupt, but just moving the stones to where Stonehenge is located, but also getting some of the stones on top of the others.
Oh, that's right.
So you I mean, those...
How did they do that?
Those of you who know what it looks like will know that it's...
It's like two stones with a kind of top across the two.
I think originally, I'm not sure. I mean, we're listeners, obviously, we're not experts. We don't present ourselves as experts here. We're just two people talking about this subject. But I think that what it originally looked like was, so, standing stones in a circle with stones going around the top as well.
That's right.
So how did they get those huge, extremely heavy stones up there?
Well, there's that question. Yeah. I mean, there is a theory I read about when I was actually in Pembrokeshire in Wales, looking at the rock where these things apparently came from. Mm-hmm. And there is a huge amount of seaweed on that part of the coast.
Seaweed?
Seaweed is these brown plants that grow in the sea. Okay. Slimy, yeah. Right?
Slimy, slippery.
There's lots of different kinds of seaweed, but one of them has got big, wide... sort of leaves which are very, very leathery and slippery and quite strong.
Ah.
And somebody had postulated that you could actually use the seaweed to slide these things. And I thought, that's an interesting thought. There was an awful lot of seaweed. I mean, you could have barrow loads of it, you know, horses pulling carts full of wet seaweed.
Right.
Putting it down in front of the rock and sliding it because it's being towed by more horses and things.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, that's an interesting thought. You know, it's more likely than this logs theory for my liking. Yeah. Anyway, so they took an awful lot of effort doing it.
It's fascinating to speculate on it, though, isn't it?
Yes.
That, you know, because we don't know, it kind of lets your mind, your imagination run wild a little bit. Or sort of to an extent, you can kind of speculate based on what we do know and based on sort of... what would be reasonable, and start to imagine what must have happened. It is mysterious.
Yes,
and fascinating.
It is mysterious. When I was a child at school, we were told stories with picture books about the ancient Britons. Now, the ancient Britons is a way of describing the Celts, the Celtish tribes that occupied these islands, you know, before the Romans arrived. And the books would show the ancient Britons wearing animal skins and kind of, you know, hunting things with spears. Well, we now know from later discoveries and carbon dating that there were really sophisticated societies going on much, much longer ago than that. I seem to remember in the Netherlands, they found some sort of fossilized spears.
And,
yeah, you know, like javelins. And this was a camp where they were horsemen. You know, it's flat country in the Netherlands, and they were horsemen. And they apparently hunted wild horses because there was a lot of horse remains, and they'd obviously been cooked and eaten. And they carbon dated these spears, and they were, I think, 25,000 years old.
Whoa, 25,000 years old.
So we're talking about sophisticated societies that go a long way back, yeah. And we don't know anything about them.
Yeah, it's incredible, isn't it?
And so we do know a bit about the Anglo-Saxons who moved in from mainland Europe after the Roman Empire had collapsed, and that was the era where the Vikings moved into our islands from Scandinavia, and the Anglo-Saxons moved in from Germany and Denmark, and so on,
yeah.
Mainland Europe. Well, they were very sophisticated. Beautiful jewellery has survived,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of poetry and other things.
Yeah.
So I imagine, you know, you can go back thousands of years and you would have had something similar.
Right.
So Stonehenge, yes, but there's lots more. I was very struck in Scotland. We went on holiday to the Outer Hebrides.
Where's that?
It's on the northwest side of Scotland,
mm-hmm.
and it's a chain of islands out in the Atlantic.
Okay.
There are Inner Hebrides, much closer to the mainland. The Isle of Skye is one of those. The Outer Hebrides, if I remember rightly, there is North Uist, South Uist, Benbecula, and Harris. These are the main islands, and they kind of tend to be long and thin. People can look at the map and they'll see them out there to the northwest of Scotland. It's very remote, but also very beautiful. And on Harris, there is another stone monument dating from around the same period. It's called the Callanish Stones. I think it's fabulous.
What does it look like?
They are very tall stones on a hill, and they are in the shape of a big cross. So there's two avenues of stones which cross in the middle, and at the middle there is a circle.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of cross with a circle, quite big. And the Callanish Stones have also got other stone circles within sight if you're there. There's another Callanish, smaller one, within sight further away.
So if you're standing in the middle,
there you can see several. On different parts of the island.
In the distance, because it's on a hilltop, is it?
Yes, that's right.
So if you stand on that hilltop in the middle of the circle of stones, you can see others in the distance.
Again, it must have been a fantastic effort to get these huge, very, very hard and heavy stones in position and lifted up. Some of them are very tall. Very spectacular. It's a great setting. A lot of films have used the Callanish Stones as a background because it's such a fantastic scene. But also in Scotland, on the Scottish Islands, there are lots of other monuments. There's lots of burial mounds, lots and lots of burial mounds.
What are burial mounds?
It's just, it looks like a little hill,
yeah.
But it's actually made by people. And it's where you bury somebody important.
Okay.
And some of these burial mounds are very sophisticated. There's one in the island of Orkney, which is the other side of Scotland, which I went to, and there's a kind of stone tunnels made of slabs. So there's a doorway into it,
mm-hmm.
and you have to crawl in.
Yeah.
And you can crawl down this tunnel of stone.
Yeah.
And at the end, there's a chamber where obviously the famous person's body was going to be, along with various artifacts.
What kind of famous person are we talking about? And again,
a local king, you know, an earl.
Yeah. So, and again, this is similar period to Stonehenge, is it?
Not necessarily. It could be more recent. The burial mounds, some of them go right back, and some of them are slightly more recent. I can't remember this one, but the interesting thing, I think it was quite an old one. The interesting thing about this burial mound was that on Midsummer's Day, the longest day of the year, if you were in that chamber and looked out of the tunnel, you could just see the sun rising over the highest peak of the mountain range.
Wow.
So there's a mountain sticking up on the horizon.
Yeah.
And the sun appears on that peak at that moment, and it shines straight down the tunnel and illuminates the little chamber.
So it sends that one particular moment sends a shaft of light right into the middle of the chamber.
Shoots its light down and it lights the chamber.
Wow.
So how did they do that?
It's Indiana Jones stuff, that
it's
is.
It's fantastic.
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of interesting things about prehistory. We call it prehistory because we don't know much about it. And I like the British Isles in that way. It's got very ancient history, and it's the kind of history I like. It's about the sea. It's about tough environments, hard environments, the north, and you know, different tribes, the Celts, of course, who are famously amazing. And then later on, the Vikings and the others who came to our islands and celebrated their religions and their gods.
And a sort of a deep understanding and respect and worship of the sun and the moon and constellations in the sky. And these people would have had a great level of sort of knowledge, but their own sort of knowledge about where the sun is at certain times of the year and the cycles and all these sorts of things. And so for Stonehenge, for example, isn't it true that there are certain stones which on Midsummer's day or Midsummer's night, when the sun comes up, the sun comes up at a specific point, and the whole of Stonehenge has been designed around this particular moment so that the sun shines? You probably know more
definitely
about it.
Definitely. No, that's absolutely right. They call it a giant clock, and that the layout is definitely aligned with the sun, the moon, and the stars. And, of course, in these ancient times, people must have been very closely connected with the natural world. They must have known, you know, a great deal about nature.
Mm-hmm.
They were sharing the territory with animals and birds and insects and plants. Plants in particular, they're particularly good at knowing, you know, what you could eat, what did you good, what didn't, and how to treat them. But also, you can imagine, there's no light pollution, none whatsoever.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Okay. Imagine looking up at night and seeing the fantastic starscape.
Yeah.
Imagine watching the moon and trying to work out what was going on there. And they could quite obviously realize when it was going to, you know, turn up. And when it was going to be full and when it was not. And, you know, it doesn't take very long for people to work that one out. And they must have had all sorts of really fascinating theories about these things. So I like all that. I like the ancient British cultures that are mysterious.
For me, I can't help thinking of Lord of the Rings, the book, rather than the film, because the film, they don't have enough time to deal with certain little details. But the book contains certain references or certainly a kind of an atmosphere of that kind of mystery and wonder of the British landscape. Certainly the earlier passages of the Fellowship of the Ring, like when Frodo and the other hobbits end up being, what is it, they get, you know the section I'm talking about with the Barrow Whites.
Oh, yes, and the trolls.
Yeah.
They're sharing the land with other creatures. And of course, Tolkien, who, by the way, lived just down the road from here. I mean, he got married in the town we're standing in, sitting in.
Yeah, this is... Yeah.
So Tolkien, this was his patch. And the Shire, it was very much Middle England, Central England, you know, where we are now, the centre of England. Yes, he was an expert in particularly Anglo-Saxon cultures and Viking cultures, which is, you know, there's a fair amount of record of that. But yes, the Lord of the Rings touches on all these things. If you go to Ireland, I remember being very struck when I went on a holiday to Ireland and met some people who were absolutely convinced that they were sharing the island with unseen people.
Like kind of...
Well, they call them leprechauns, but that's, you know, some people think leprechauns are sort of little elves, but in Ireland that's not necessarily the case. And a leprechaun can be It's someone who isn't human. It's other. It's a spirit, and there are all sorts of stories. How, you know, you're at a crossroads and you meet somebody with a feather in their hat, and they tell you which way to go, and then you turn around and they've disappeared, and then you've had an encounter. And it's the same in Iceland. Iceland, they feel very strongly that they share the island with what they call the hidden people. And they're convinced of it. So
Iceland is not that far from the coast of northern Scotland.
Not that far. The interesting thing is all these cultures are in our folklore in all sorts of obscure ways, sometimes in folk songs, sometimes simply in stories that have been handed down, and they're still there.
So it's the mystery, the connection to natural cycles, the connection to the land and nature. Yeah, fascinating stuff. Okay. Great, good choice. Yeah, really good choice. Yeah, we could definitely dig deeper and find stories and interesting things to say about standing stones. And there are standing stones all over the country. Yep. I mean, I'm thinking of the Rollright Stones.
Oh, they're close by here.
The Rollrights are in the Cotswolds. And the Rollright Stones have turned up in episodes of Doctor Who and stuff.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
Well, they're curiously shaped stones, aren't they? Yeah, they look like kind of frozen monsters.
I made a little homemade horror film at the Rollright Stones with some friends using my mobile phone. Anyway, so there
okay,
you go.
Okay, so that's kind of first thing I like about these islands. I thought for my second choice, I could come more up to date and go for our canals.
Okay, so number two, British thing number two is canals.
Canals.
What are canals?
Man-made waterways.
Man-made waterways. Okay.
Well, people probably know all about canals. I mean, the fact is that Britain was apparently the first country to have a fully developed canal network across the country. And it was incredibly important for what we call the Industrial Revolution.
Okay, so we were talking about sort of prehistoric civilizations, 2,500 years before Christ. Now we've been brought into the industrial era. So what kind of period of time are we talking about?
We're talking 1750 to 1850.
Okay.
That kind of period, okay? And it was when Britain was discovering steam power. With some famous inventors, and producing new industrial processes, both for textiles and for steel and metal and pottery. And they needed lots of coal to fire up these things. And we do have a lot of coal in Britain.
Coal mines.
And a lot of coal mines, particularly in the north.
Well, not so many anymore.
Not anymore.
Because they were closed down?
And, of course, trying to move, you know, iron ore and coal, not to mention the finished goods. Imagine if you're making pottery, you know, making plates.
Yeah.
And then you want to get them to a port, get them exported. The only way you could get them there was to put them on a pack horse or put them in a cart. And the roads were just muddy and rutted, so not so good.
Because the plates are going to get broken.
And then, you know, it was thought that maybe we can develop river transport and connect up some of the rivers with man-made trenches. And the first one, I think, mid-18th century, was called the Bridgewater Canal. And it was made by a very rich landowner, Duke of Bridgewater. And in the north of England, and he owned coal mines.
Okay.
And he decided that he needed canals to move the coal to the industrial centre, Manchester in particular, but also Birmingham. And, of course, he was immensely rich, so he could afford to have all these hundreds of workers to dig these canals, which are amazing pieces of work, fantastic pieces of work, complete with locks if you have to raise the water level. They have these sort of famous things called locks where the water goes in one end, the boat rises up, and then the gates open at the other end, and the boat goes out, like steps.
Yeah, because if you're building a canal network and you have to deal with hills where the land rises and falls, and you don't want all the water to just sort of slosh down to one end, if you want to keep the water level level, then how do you deal with that when the land around it is moving up and down? What do you do?
Well, they're called locks, and just near where we're sitting at the moment, there is one of the longest series of locks in the country. It's called Hatton Flight. The Hatton Flight has got, I think, 23 locks in a row.
It's a bit like sort of steps in water, isn't it, sort of thing?
And that's on the Grand Union Canal, which connected London and Liverpool. So the canals were a huge success. The Duke of Bridgewater got his money back within 2 years, apparently, having invested a huge amount in building his canal.
Good investment.
Everybody saw this as the way to go. The famous pottery manufacturer in Stoke-on-Trent, Josiah Wedgwood, he invested in canals to transport his precious chinaware and also to get coal in to fire up his ovens. And so the canal network grew very rapidly all over the place, and there were people investing madly in canals because that was where the money was, and it cut the cost of transport and completely. These canal barges...
Boats on the canals.
Yeah, they're called barges, or sometimes narrow boats, because the canals were very narrow and the boats had to be thin.
And long.
They were long and thin. These were towed by horses. So each canal had a tow path alongside it where the horse would walk. And it was very efficient. One horse, apparently, could carry about 30 tons of coal or whatever in a boat.
Because of the lack of horse. Because of the lack of friction.
No friction.
Because the boat is on the water, and so there's very little friction there. So the one horse can actually pull a very heavy load.
Yeah, so they were brilliant. The biggest engineer in this part of the country, in the Midlands, was called James Brindley. James Brindley was a great engineer who did a lot of the building of the canals. His name is remembered in Birmingham in street names and in shopping centres and one thing and another. Mm. Brindley also did a lot of work connecting them up so that it became a network. And there was a golden age of canals. They say it was 1770 to 1830, where the canals kind of were really important. And Birmingham, which is the second biggest city in Britain, wasn't much of a city then, but it was at an intersection of two canals, and it grew incredibly fast. They used to call it the Silver Cross. Mm-hmm. Silver Cross.
Why the Silver Cross?
Well, because of two canals crossing at Birmingham.
Silver meaning like the reflection of the water.
That's right. Thread of water.
Yeah.
So the canals made a huge impact on Britain. They fueled the Industrial Revolution. It made Britain incredibly rich. Also helped the colonialization and all that.
Because it suddenly allowed this industry of spices and textiles and other materials that could be brought in from other countries, brought into ports like Liverpool or Southampton.
And transported to the big city.
Transported all around the city, to all around the country, to these industrial places where they would be then transformed into different goods that could be then sold.
So that's the history of the canals, and what killed them off? What do you think killed off the canals?
The invention of the car, the motor car?
No.
The railway?
The railway.
Yeah.
No, it was the railway. And of course, once they'd started building railways, and again, Britain was an innovator in building railways, it was much quicker, mm-hmm. much faster to transport things by rail than by canal. And the canal companies started to go bust. And sometimes the rail companies bought them out to eliminate the competition. And the railways took over. And so the canals fell into a steady decline. And they have only been revived in relatively recent times.
How have they been revived then recently?
In about the 1960s, people started realizing that these canals were a resource and that they should be cleaned up, if you like.
Yeah.
And they're now used for leisure a lot. We've been on a canal holiday. It was absolutely wonderful. You get into a long, narrow boat and chug along these beautiful canals.
These the narrow boats, I mean, you talked before about how they were pulled by horses, but obviously later on the engines... Diesel engines were put into them.
That's
so
right.
Yeah. And they also, these days, these narrow boats that people either spend time on during holidays or actually they live in them, they have, you know, kitchens in them, they've got living quarters, toilets and stuff.
Yes, in fact, when the canals started going to decline, the people who worked on the canals found their wages being cut and their wages being cut.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them had to bring their families on board the boat. They had to live on the boat.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't afford anywhere else.
Yeah.
And this produced a kind of a culture, the boat people. The boat people lived on the canal boats.
Yeah.
And they had their own artwork and their own language, their own habits.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so there's a little bit of tradition of the canal boat being a little cozy home with a little bedroom in it and everything else.
Mm.
So there was the leisure thing, but also in the big cities, the canals suddenly became fashionable. Once they'd been kind of cleaned up and there were nice canal side walks and you could go jogging beside the canals and you could go cycling by the canals, and then suddenly they were building apartments in the old factories and the old mills which stood by the canals, converting them into classy apartments to live in, and canal-side living, you know, in places like Manchester and Birmingham, became very fashionable. So the canals have revived now, and they're completely different. They're smart, they're a leisure facility, and there are canal-side restaurants, cafes, pubs, and all that kind of thing. And it takes you away from the traffic. You know, you step away from the traffic down maybe a flight of steps. There you are on the canal side. And it's very pleasant, especially in the summer,
yeah,
to sit beside the canal and have a pint.
Yes. And I'm thinking of famous sort of canal side locations. For example, Camden Lock. I don't know if you've been there recently, but these...
Not recently. It's in London, right?
Yeah, it's amazing. It's a really cool place to go. There are loads of interesting places to get food, cafes, shops and restaurants. It's just a really cool spot to hang out in London now, canal, Camden Lock. And you can walk all the way from Camden, all the way down the canal, past Regent's Park, past London Zoo, all the way through to many other parts of London.
There you go. And you don't have to cross a road. You don't have to get involved in the traffic, yeah, and the buses. And it's actually a different way of looking at places. When you see places from the canal side, you see things in the way you haven't seen them before, from a different angle. No, it's a great success, the revival of the canals. So instead of carrying coal, that's what they do.
One of my friends actually lives on a canal boat.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, he used to live in West London. He had a flat there, but he sold his flat and bought a canal boat, obviously, you know, much cheaper than his apartment was. But now he lives on a canal boat, and I've spoken to him on the podcast several times. So listeners, Moz is his nickname, M-O-Z. And he lives on the canal boat, and it's very interesting because he's kind of constantly moving around the network. He spends a lot of time in London, but also he can take his boat up to different parts
of
the canal network.
That is interesting, isn't it?
And he's allowed to stay in a certain spot for about 2 weeks before he has to move on. So he's constantly on the move, and he wakes up in the morning and he comes out of the boat, and he gets to see these beautiful scenes often of nature. He's right there on the water, so there are ducks and geese and swans and things, and it must be lovely, actually. He's got a stove in his boat that keeps him warm. It's kind of sort of very attractive idea,
it's
actually.
It's a different lifestyle.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you can't move your house around like that, but also you can't have a snooker table in a
yeah,
canal boat.
Yeah. Okay, nice one. So the canal network, interesting. Very interesting stuff. By the way, listeners, we're recording this on New Year's Eve, and it's just Dad and me sitting here in the living room. Mum's gone to bed because she was tired. This is how we celebrate New Year's Eve these days. My wife is not with us at the moment, but my daughter is upstairs asleep. My brother's elsewhere. So it's just Dad and me, And well, we were like, what should we do? Let's record this podcast we've been talking about. So it's
we're going to coming up to the year 2020 quite soon.
It's about how many minutes away? It's now 11. It's 11:52. So in about 7 or 8 minutes, it'll be 2020.
The end of the decade. Into 2020.
I set my
own. So we'll have to let everybody join in with the countdown to midnight, which is midnight UK time.
Yeah.
I mean, they've already got there in mainland Europe, but, you know, they can join in with us. Right. Let's crack on.
Let's crack on. There's that phrase again, folks. I talked about that with James. Anyway, so what's your third thing? And by the way, I've set my phone to an alarm on my phone.
Okay, it's so going to go beep, beep.
It'll go beep, beep 2 minutes before midnight, so then we can kind of just sort of take a pause to sort of bring in the new year and then carry on. All right, so anyway,
okay.
What's the
one's slightly connected. It's Northern Landscapes. Basically. Yeah. The British Isles has a whole different range of landscapes. Now, no other countries do, particularly big countries, like France, for example. But they seem to be particularly interesting in Britain, and I particularly like northern landscapes.
I would say that probably most of the tourists or visitors to the UK probably start in London. Probably London attracts most of the tourists, and as a result of that, I wonder how many, probably not that many, get up to areas in the north.
Yeah, I would think a minority. And I know some get as far as Stratford-upon-Avon here, say hello, there's Shakespeare's birthplace, mm-hmm. and some will get up to Edinburgh in Scotland, but Edinburgh's a city. And I'm interested in more rural landscapes, more remote landscapes, and we're very maritime nation. You know, we have an awful lot of coastline, and the coastlines are different too. Geologically, you mentioned geology right at the beginning. Geologically, we're on a kind of a tilted plate. So, if you imagine British Isles on a plate, mm-hmm. and then you tilt it slightly, so that the eastern end dips down towards the sea and the western end tilts up.
Okay,
now it's basically what we've got. We've got cliffs all the way along the western side, and then you know we have got some cliffs elsewhere. But in East Anglia. In the southeast, it kind of runs into some lowlands, marshlands, and sandy bits.
Yeah, I'm thinking of places like Norfolk, where very, very flat, mm. and that flat land runs right into the sea. Mm. And you know, there's problems like the fact the sea is encroaching on farmland and stuff. But there, we don't have cliffs on the east side. But we've many
well, we
cliffs
do a
on,
bit up in, yeah. when you get up into North Yorkshire, you yeah. certainly do, and Scotland. So it's a simplistic way of looking at it, but it is a bit like that.
Okay.
And northern landscapes are the ones I like because they're rugged. They can be wild in bad weather. They can be spectacular, stormy. And I like wildlife, and I like the wildlife you get around our northern coasts. And the cry of the gulls and the, you know, all the other thing. Gulls are these white seagulls.
Yeah, birds.
People call them seagulls, but they're actually called gulls.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I like northern landscapes, and I think they're a bit romantic. The Anglo-Saxon poetry that survived over the ages has a lot celebrating northern landscapes and the trials and tribulations of the people who had to live in them. Mm-hmm. There's a famous Anglo-Saxon poem called The Wanderer, and the wanderer is described as being on his boat and being lashed by the sea and ice in his beard and the cry of the eagles and all that kind of stuff. Mm. It's a great poem. And also I like the artwork of a man called Norman Ackroyd. Norman Ackroyd does old-fashioned style etchings.
Is that an Ackroyd up there?
Yes, it is an Ackroyd up there on the wall.
That's a picture of?
It's the Skelligs, is it?
It's Michael Skellig?
It's...
Skellig Michael. It's one of the Skelligs.
Yes, I think it is one of the Skellig
Which
Islands.
Listeners, you know, Star Wars fans will know that Acto, where Luke Skywalker goes to in episode eight, that is one of the Skellig Islands. But there's a Norman Ackroyd etching of one of the Skelligs on the wall here. It's a very atmospheric shot with a rough sea and moody, cloudy sky and stuff.
Right, your alarm has just gone twitch, isn't that right?
That was my wife texting me saying, ready to scream.
Oh, no.
Like she
thinks we're going to scream.
Listeners, she's doing it the right way. She's out with some friends celebrating. I'm being boring and staying in. I'm not a fan of New Year's Eve. I like to be in. I like to stay in, and I'd rather not be out on this particular night. I like to be in where it's cozy and warm on New Year's Eve. And to celebrate in a low-key kind of way like this. But my wife's out celebrating and partying with some friends.
Wow, she's a party animal.
She might call me at midnight. We'll see. Oh, there's the alarm.
Oh, there's the alarm.
So that's the alarm.
I've got to turn the TV on.
2 minutes till 2020, ladies and gents.
So I'm tuning into the BBC on the TV.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in London. Where we're going to have a great firework display, of course. I can see him standing in front of Westminster Abbey. I can see the River Thames behind and the London Eye, the big wheel.
Huge crowds of people down there.
Lots of crowds, lots of crowds of people. So we'll wait for the countdown, Luke.
We'll do the countdown. It's going to happen very soon. Yeah. But
so I was just talking about Norman Aykroyd,
artist
who uses very traditional old-fashioned techniques of etching using acid in a great big bath, and the acid, you know, burns out a plate, and then he prints off the plate and it gets this particular quality. It's normally in black and white, and I feel as though the northern landscapes are in black and white anyway. There isn't any colour there
because it's quite dark.
I'm sure that's not true. But,
no.
I just like that stuff. I like the coast. I like the cliffs, and I like the fairly remote areas. I come from the north. I was born in Yorkshire, but I didn't really stay there long enough to appreciate it. I left when I was 9 years old.
Yeah.
But I do remember, going off to the Yorkshire coast and to the moors, which are the uplands, and to the dales, which are the beautiful little valleys. Yorkshire's a big county. I think it's the biggest county.
The countdown is happening.
Oh, 13. Here we go.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Here we go, folks. There we go. Happy New Year. Is that actually Big Ben?
That is Big Ben.
They fixed it.
Especially.
You can hear the fireworks.
Wow, very spectacular.
And Big Ben, or the bell. The Big Ben is actually the bell. What's going to happen now is a massive and outrageously expensive firework display.
Yes, it's happening. It's happening.
Like in many cities around the world. It is quite impressive, I have to say, the firework display that they usually have in London on New Year's Eve. I think that's... What are we going to do here, Dad? You want to watch the display, don't you?
Yeah.
I think Dad wants to watch the display.
No, I don't.
You're okay?
Yeah.
Well, anyway, okay. Dad, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Luke.
We have got drinks. I've got a beer. You've got a glass of wine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cheers,
mate. Mm-hmm. Well, here we are into 2020.
2020, a new decade.
Yes, I'll be pleased to see the back of 2019. Not a lot good happened in 2019.
Yeah, well... Anyway, Happy New Year, Dad.
New Year.
I should give you a hug because that's what people do on New Year's Eve. Yeah. There you go, Dad. It's nice to spend New Year's Eve with you.
Yes, it's certainly nice to have you all here for Christmas and the New Year.
Yeah.
So, do you need to talk to your wife or not?
Well, she hasn't called me yet. She probably will.
She'll probably FaceTime you some.
Yeah, she's written nice things to me.
Oh.
That's really sweet.
Oh.
I'm lucky.
Oh.
She's writing lovely messages to me.
She's working in France.
Yeah, she went back a little bit early because she had lots of work to do. Oh, she's written some really sweet things. I'm gonna speak to her soon. So we should.
Okay, well, we'll wind up quickly.
Yeah.
So there you are. I just like the landscapes.
Yeah.
And it's a pity that visitors don't get the chance to go to Wales, go to, you know, Cornwall, Scotland, obviously. Northern Ireland's beautiful. And north of England, Yorkshire particularly.
I mean,
lovely landscapes, fantastic.
You mentioned Yorkshire. I remember, you mentioned Yorkshire. Maybe we can talk about that in a second as the fireworks continue in London there on the TV. But I remember, talking of atmospheric northern landscapes, I remember as a family, 1 year we went on holiday to the northeast, right? We went up and we did a really, really good walk along the northeastern coastline towards Lindisfarne Castle.
Yeah.
Where is Lindisfarne Castle?
It's Northumberland. It's northern Northumberland.
Northumberland.
And it's a little island, Lindisfarne, and you go across a kind of causeway to it.
Yeah.
It's where the monks used to be.
A big castle on an island off the coast of Northumberland. Northumberland is just sort of south of the Scottish border.
That's right.
And incredibly atmospheric place. And that's right, to get to the castle, you have to walk along a causeway, which is sort of like a pathway. But when the tide is up, so when the sea is high, the pathway disappears and the tide comes racing in covers the path, so that the castle on the island is cut off and is just sort of on its own in the sea. Amazing place. And there were, you know, lots of bird life there and everything. And I just remember having a really fantastic time walking along the coast and then walking along the causeway to the castle and then walking back and seeing the tide racing in, like seeing the water rushing in.
Yes, that's right.
It's a
different landscape, different experience from, you know, being in London or you know, getting in your car and going to work and everything else. It's so refreshing to go to somewhere completely different, completely wild and with big sky. You know, I like that.
Yeah.
Where you're walking and there's lots of sky.
Again, it makes
listeners may hear some more fireworks. It's actually coming from outside the window here because we're next to Warwick Castle and Warwick Castle is having a firework display.
Yeah, it's a fantastic. Another, talking of castles, Warwick Castle is one of the best castles in the country.
It's one of the biggest medieval castles in Europe.
So these northern landscapes and northern locations, I mentioned before Lord of the Rings, but it is that kind of thing. Like, Tolkien was very influenced by these sorts of locations, and also Game of Thrones, certainly the books, I would say. The TV series, a lot of it was filmed in Northern Ireland. But
they're quite popular. I mean, you know, Braveheart, the film, and other things that use these kind of remote locations, they're quite good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right then.
Okay, well, Dan, thank you for talking to us about some of your favourite
British... Some of the things I like about Britain.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And so what I must do is take a photo of that that Aykroyd etching. Is it an etching? Is that...
Yes.
Yeah? It's not a painting, it's
no,
an etching.
No, it's an etching.
I must take a photograph of that etching of one of the Skellig Islands, which is an island off Ireland, by the way, so not technically a British thing.
Yes, I think it belongs to Ireland.
Yes, definitely. Just to give you an idea of what Dad was talking about when he mentioned...
And we went there.
We did.
Me and James, we went on a little boat. I mean, the sea was amazing. Poof, poof, great waves and everything else.
Yeah.
We went past the island, which has all the seabirds, the gannets,
yeah,
flying around. And then we had to climb up this rickety little staircase up to the top.
Just like in Star Wars.
Just in Star Wars.
So we did that. We climbed up there and we saw a lot of... there weren't any... what are they called? Porgs. No porgs up there.
Didn't we see any porgs?
No, we didn't see...
There
were puffins. Loads of puffins.
There were puffins.
We didn't see Luke
puffins
Skywalker.
Puffins are birds, by the way.
But... yeah, so been there, done that. We didn't get a T-shirt, but there it is. Dad, thank you so much for talking to
me. It's been my pleasure. Happy New Year again.
Happy New Year to you. Thank you also for your contributions to Luke's English Podcast over the last, decade or
probably
more?
Probably.
It's been 10 years. It's been over 10 years now. And you were in episode 2.
I was?
Yes, you were. We talked about Easter.
Really?
Yeah, you don't remember that, but that was way back in 2009. We talked about Easter.
Okay, well, your podcast goes from strength to strength. I know that it's very popular with lots of people, and I hope they appreciate the fact that you can entertain them while they learn English as it is spoken here. I think it's quite a useful way of learning English, really. And obviously, if people want to go to a higher level, they've got your premium service. But a lot of people will just go for your free service and listen and enjoy.
Yes, absolutely. That's the idea. Okay, listeners, Happy New Year to all of you. And I'll speak to you again on the podcast soon. Thank you again, Dad.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, then.
Bye.
So that was my dad with his three quintessentially British things. As ever, I invite you to write your comments in the comment section if you have any. And don't be a ninja hiding in the shadows like the vast majority of my listeners. All that remains to be done is for me to remind you to download the Luke's English Podcast app from the App Store to get the entire episode archive, plus loads of bonus extras, and also to sign up to LEP Premium, where I teach you grammar, vocabulary and pronunciation using target language, which has occurred naturally in normal episodes of the podcast. To get started with that, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium. Right then, thank you for listening, and I'll speak to you again in the next one, which is going to be three quintessentially British things with Mum. But for now, it's just time to say goodbye. Bye. 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 Thanks for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.